Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Last week, the Canby City Council narrowly passed a resolution calling on the state to end pandemic-related business closure and other restrictions, following a discussion that seemed to go far beyond the merits of the non-binding, symbolic statement. Instead, the matter cast into sharp relief the difference that can divide the members of the council, and by extension, residents who agree with one side or the other, differences that the 14-month coronavirus pandemic and associated restrictions have only intensified. At City Council Wednesday night, some of those frustrations bubbled over. The resolution was introduced by Mayor Brian Hodson, inspired by a similar, though more full-throated, statement that Baker City passed in March, but which has gained statewide and even national attention in the past week. Hudson maintained that the resolution was about rallying around Canby's small businesses, particularly restaurants, bars, and gyms that have been disproportionately impacted by the state's COVID rules. To me, this is not a partisan issue or a partisan resolution, Hudson said. We are saying enough with the yanking around of our businesses, their livelihoods, and the livelihoods of their employees. Other councillors, however, saw it as explicitly partisan. Councillor Sarah Spoon derided what she called the garbage resolution, saying it accomplishes nothing for local businesses and could be detrimental to public health and safety. It is wrought with unverified claims, inaccuracies, and vague inflammatory and ideological language that is purely political theater and nothing more, she said Wednesday, reading from a prepared statement. Feelings aren't facts, and this whole resolution is full of feelings and falsehoods. Earlier in the meeting, Spoon, along with Councillor Chris Bangs, had grilled the mayor to substantiate various claims the resolution makes, including that statewide coronavirus restrictions have led to bankruptcies, food and housing insecurity, and a significant rise in domestic violence, crimes of desperation, mental health impacts, and suicide risks in Canby. For the most part, he was unable to provide supporting data Wednesday night, but later admitted some of the language was extreme and liberties may have been taken, but said he did know of two local businesses that had declared bankruptcy due to COVID-19. That is not what I'm asking, Hodson said. I have never been asking our businesses not to follow those, because we can't, we shouldn't. The purpose of this is to say to the governor, this is now the fourth or fifth shutdown on many of our mom and pop shops. That is not what I'm asking, Hudson said. I have never been asking our businesses to not follow those because we can't. We shouldn't. The purpose of this is to say to the governor, this is now the fourth or fifth shutdown on many of our mom and pop businesses, and they've been impacted. The strategy isn't working, and it's time for a different strategy. But some felt the resolution sends the opposite message to the community. And impassioned bangs went through the draft resolution virtually word by word, insisting that Hodson defend his description of state restrictions on certain businesses as arbitrary, and explain specifically the constitutional rights or civil liberties that the resolution claimed had been violated. At one point, Bangs referenced comments Hudson made during a council meeting in November that there had been relatively few, if any, confirmed cases of the virus tied to restaurants, bars, and fitness centers in Canby. Look, Mr. Mayor, if I seem a little bit fired up about this, I have to tell you, I feel like you're kind of like the mayor in the movie Jaws, saying the water's safe, Bangs said. You said the restaurants were safe. My son got COVID in one of those restaurants in Canby a month after you said that. That was my boy. You said the water was safe. Councillor Jordan Tibbles shared the mayor's views, and the resolution signaled the city's support for small and struggling businesses. It's so easy to say, order more takeout, do your part, he said. But we have an opportunity to stand as free Americans against the tyrannical orders that our governor is doing, which don't make any sense. Tibbles claimed the statewide shutdowns have unfairly targeted small businesses over well-heeled corporations like Walmart and Costco because they lacked the financial wherewithal to fight the regulations. He also argued the mask mandate had been psychologically damaging, describing an incident in a park where an older girl reacted to his daughter with apparent fear because she wasn't wearing a mask. We were always going to disagree on this, but we live in a free country, he concluded. If people want to get vaccinated, they have the freedom to do that. But people also have the freedom to make a living, put food on their table, and not have to worry about the government shutting them down. Councillors split on the resolution 3-3, with the mayor casting the tie-breaking vote. The resolution took effect immediately. For an even longer version of the story, visit our website, canbyfirst.com. For more than 25 years in the Oregon restaurant industry, Claude DeCourcy has never seen anything like it. Coronavirus restrictions are slowly lifting in Clackamas County and across the state. And hungry diners, such as myself, eager for a return to some semblance of normalcy after the 14-month pandemic, are swarming their favorite restaurants and watering holes. There's just one more teensy problem. A historic labor shortage of waitstaff, cooks, and bartenders affecting virtually the entire hospitality industry. Never, DeCourcy simply says, when asked if he had seen such a serious labor shortage in the industry before. I have literally had people tell me that they don't wake up until 2 in the afternoon and they don't have to worry about anything because they're making enough money on unemployment. DeCourcy owns 4 restaurants, a Pita Pit in downtown Portland, Pizza Schmitza Pub and Grub in Wilsonville, and 2 Schmitza public houses, one in Gresham and the second in Oregon City, which just opened Friday. He has job openings at all 4. At this point, I could hire 10 people right now, he says. And I just can't find anybody. And even when people do apply, they don't answer the phone when you call. His situation in Oregon City became so desperate this week that he began offering $1,000 signing bonuses for cooks, an unusual incentive in this business, but one that has become increasingly common amid the labor shortage, even being offered by some fast food restaurants. That's perhaps the one silver lining here is that it has created increased bargaining leverage for workers that they might not normally have had, though DeCourcy insists that those looking to sweeten their deals must still be realistic. Some of the wages I've had people asking me for are simply not feasible, he says. Restaurants work on such small margins. I can't afford to pay somebody $50,000 a year to cook a hamburger. Other employers have also said that they know of former or prospective employees that prefer continuing to receive unemployment benefits, which the American Rescue Plan Act sweetened with an additional $300 per week until Labor Day, then returning to the workforce. For unemployed Oregonians, That works out to an average weekly benefit of $670, the equivalent of nearly $17 an hour, well above the state's minimum wage of $11.50 to $13.25, depending on the region. The problem is that the increased federal benefit is temporary and unlikely to be renewed if current trends continue. My response to them has been, come September, that's probably going to be gone, along with all these jobs, DeCourcy says. Customers, some of whom have waited months to return to the restaurant scene, are not always understanding of a kitchen being shorthanded, and DeCourcy doesn't really expect them to be. Customers don't really care if you're understaffed, he says with a laugh. And I get that too. They want their stuff. It's not their fault I can't get anybody to come into work. A police pursuit ended in a shooting on Highway 213 in Oregon City Saturday night, with one officer also being hospitalized with undisclosed injuries. According to the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, the chase stopped at 6:46 p.m. on the Interstate 205 on-ramp from Highway 213 in Oregon City. The Sheriff's Office did not say who fired shots, only that officers were involved in a shooting. The suspect was injured and taken to the hospital. The Sheriff's Office says he was treated and released to investigators later in the night. An Oregon City police officer helping with the pursuit was also hurt. He was taken to the hospital with serious but not life-threatening injuries. The Clackamas County District Attorney's Office and the Major Crimes Team are taking over the investigation. The case has been referred to the County District Attorney to consider charges. Highway 213 was closed in both directions from I-205 to Redland Road for several hours while investigators worked the scene. One of the few remaining unused commercial spaces in the Dahlia Building in downtown Cambie has been leased by one of the area's premier providers of mutual-based physical therapy and sports medicine services, the Cambie Current has learned. Therapeutic Associates Physical Therapy, a partnership of individually owned and operated clinics whose history dates back 60 years and which boasts about 70 locations across the Pacific Northwest, has leased about two-thirds of the Dahlia's remaining space, which faces North Ivy Street. Their new location at the Dahlia is currently under construction and is expected to open as soon as renovations are completed, likely in August. They are thrilled to be in Cambie in the historic downtown. Mary Hanlon, the founder and principal of Hanlon Development, which is the managing member of the Dahlia and is leading the redevelopment of the Cambie Civic Block, told The Current. They are a great regional group and they are really glad to have this profile downtown. They get it. Therapeutic Associates was founded in 1952 by physical therapists Jim McKillop and Robert Dickus and was one of the pioneers of outpatient physical therapy practices. Today, it is a physical therapist-owned and operated organization with a broad range of expertise specializing in the whole body with locations throughout Oregon as well as Washington, Idaho, and California. We invest in every city and town we serve with unparalleled patient care and so much more, the collective says on its website. This includes traditionally working with physicians, nurses, case managers, and others involved with our patients. Therapeutic Associates says it also engages with employers to prevent employee injuries, sharing education through healthcare forums, and participating in community events to assist in the well-being of workers and our neighbors. To answer the question that has been asked in the local Facebook groups only 740,000 times, with a varying degree of panic, over the past week or so, no, the Taco Bell restaurant on Highway 99E in Cambie is not closing permanently. Instead, the approximately 2,100 square foot building is undergoing an exterior refresh and other improvements the Cambie Planning Commission approved in January. The Cambie Planning Commission will next week consider plans for exterior renovations and other improvements at the Taco Bell restaurant on Highway 99E Strip. The planned development includes moving the wraparound drive-through lane closer to the existing building, removing 12 parking stalls, installing a drive-through canopy, and updating the menu board and signage. Reducing the parking lot size will still leave 18 spaces for the restaurant, which primarily serves through drive-through customers, even before the coronavirus pandemic. Other changes include increased landscaping and a new trash enclosure. The Canby Taco Bell is located at 845 Southwest 1st Avenue and is owned by the Tofty Family Trust. For architectural renderings of the plans, find this story on our website, canbyfirst.com.
Hey Tyler, I was reading an article the other day and I saw that 53% of Americans say they value technology even more since the COVID outbreak.
Oh, yeah, I think I saw that article in Obvious News Weekly.
Okay, you don't have to be mean.
Seriously though, it is true. I know that I can't function anymore without all of my connected devices. And I heard that DirectLink saw a huge spike in internet traffic after the stay-at-home order began last year.
Yeah, it's a good thing DirectLink works hard to provide constant, reliable broadband service even during tough weather, peak use hours, and that big jump in increased demand.
Right, and we need access to a quality connection more than ever. We're working from home, the kids are still distance learning, and I've even had a few online doctor's appointments.
Yeah, not only that, but so many of our entertainment options have gone virtual. They're streaming TV shows and movies, Zoom game nights, and online gaming, so people really need reliable internet.
Wait. With all of that extra online activity going on, don't we have to worry about usage limits and high bills from using too much data?
Come on, Tyler. How many times have we been over this? DirectLink doesn't have data caps and doesn't charge extra fees for high usage. It says so right there on their website. Visit directlink.coop today to learn more. We got a little music playing in the background because we are here at the listening session for Mayor Stan Pulliam here at Fox Park in Malala. Hi, Mayor Stan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Welcome on to Now Hear This Canby. Don't get me in any trouble with the royalties and the songs, okay?
Okay, that's right.
If I get angry, cease and desist, I'm sending them to you.
I'm a walking jukebox, you know.
Okay, yeah. All right, fair enough. So I have just a couple questions I want to ask about kind of your journey, as it were, as a public servant. Yeah. And this listening tour and how it's been so far and kind of what the plans are with it. But first, wanted to ask, because are you a candidate for governor? Sure. Are we exploring? What are we kind of doing here?
Well, we're exploring, right? So Stan Pulliam, mayor of Sandy, 11,000 population community. It's been a wild year and a half, 2 years to be mayor of your hometown.
Yeah,
you know?
I bet.
crazy. And so, you know, we've been an outspoken advocate for Main Street small businesses, getting our kids back into school. And we really kind of caught this wave here of momentum and support. And where people are really asking us to take a look at this governor's race. And so we're sitting about a year out from the primary.
There were no sort of obvious contenders or
candidates from
the Republican side.
Yeah, right. So we've started this listening tour. We're working with different mayors around the state. Obviously, we're Malala today with Mayor Kaiser. We're going to be in Canby here in the next couple of days. And just so you, we're in East Central Oregon last weekend. I was at the coast earlier in the week.
Yeah.
Just listening, trying to see how much support we can get, you know, what the vitality of this campaign can be, what kind of financial support, because, you know, it's been 40 years since there's been a Republican governor in Oregon, and I think for a lot of those reasons for that is it's because we haven't done the proper legwork and stuff to get organized and run a really top-end campaign, and that's what we're committed to doing here.
Awesome. Well, we don't often have gubernatorial candidates on our podcast. We don't cover that race to a super great degree.
Yeah.
But we do, and I do have a lot of experience talking to local politicians, right? And in my experience, they don't often go into running for mayor or running for city council with, okay, I'll do this for a couple years and then the governor's race, right?
Sure.
So I'd love to hear just a little bit more. You kind of talked about the momentum and whatnot.
Yeah.
But just kind of about your journey, maybe why you initially went into politics, and a little bit more about kind of the, I'm sure, very difficult kind of decision that you're still weighing as far as entering this much larger race.
Yeah, so kind of in my previous life, I worked around politics and local governments and in the state legislature. You know, I was a legislative director for a couple stints through the state legislature, working for guys like Senator Bruce Starr and Representative Pat Farr. Worked on some political campaigns, like for Kevin Mannix when he ran for governor, and got an opportunity to travel around and do a little bit of that. But then went into commercial insurance for 10 years and got married, had a couple kids, and wanted our kids to have the same experiences growing up that I had. So we moved back to Sandy, and Sandy's one of the fastest growing cities in Oregon. And there's a lot of strains on our infrastructure and planning, I felt, you know, wasn't happening. So we took on a popular four-term incumbent mayor, and we won. And then, as you said, the last 2 years has been pretty wild. But one thing I've learned is that, you know, things are best done at the local level. Because, you know, we have Republicans, Democrats on our city council. We got grandparents, parents, you know, all over the spectrum. But you know what we all are at the end of the day? We're neighbors. And so we tackle these problems as neighbors. And there's been a variety of issues. You know, it's been unprecedented couple of years, like we've talked about. But we've tackled all of these, you know, as people that where we put our political, you know, positions to the side and really tackled these as a community. And that's really what's got me kind of optimistic about, you know, this governor's race and taking a look at it. Is if we can really empower local communities, local school boards, and the people of Oregon, you know, there's no problem that we can't take on together as a united state.
When you're looking at something, you know, like the governor's office, I guess what would be your sort of approach to, you know, experts and advisors, right? Because I feel like you'd be coming in, you obviously do have maybe more legislative experience and larger than just the city of Sandy, excuse me, than some folks might have known. But you've never been governor before.
Yeah.
Never run a statewide office before.
Yeah.
So how would you kind of handle some of that learning curve? And that's probably a question that you're getting asked, I imagine.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, and it's been over 40 years since we've had Republican, you know, office holder in the governor's office. And so there's a lot of institutional knowledge that we'll have to build up. And what we'll be looking to do is, one, is I'll be relying heavily on mayors and local officials to come into the kind of our administration. Because what I think is important is really knowing what's going on in these local communities throughout Oregon, not just what's going on in Portland.
Yeah.
I think that's a big problem what's going on right now, is that we have a lot of politicians from Portland. They hire staff from Portland. So then we get kind of Portland beliefs, you know, forced onto the rest of us. So really looking at a broad spectrum all throughout the state to get people involved. But also, you know, really working, you know, with current staff and seeing, you know, who wants to stick around. We're looking to build an administration about Oregon, not a Republican administration, not a Democrat administration, but an administration for the people and by the people, you know, where we're really trying to go from the ground up. Not where we're forcing our ideals onto other people, but where we're finding out what's happening in these different communities and empowering you to be able to control the destiny of your own futures.
Why do you think Mayor Stan, it's been so long since we've had a Republican governor, I guess how would you try to approach it differently to change that if you do decide to go forward with this?
Yeah, I think it's been a while since we've had a candidate that's really built a ground up grassroots effort all throughout the state. You know, we've got the Main Street Mayors organization where we're working with mayors and their local communities throughout Oregon.
Yeah.
You think about it, every mayor knows, you know, their local nonprofit leaders or their small business owners, their faith community members. And then we've got, you know, my wife Mackenzie started the Oregon Moms Union, and so they're going to have a captain in every school district across the state.
Yeah.
So we're going to build an unparalleled statewide organization. We're starting early. We're going to take bold stances on the issues. You know, mayors, we don't get to sidestep these issues. We can't walk out. We can't shut down government. We've got to find extreme pragmatic answers to solve some of the most complex problems. And so, you know, that's what we're going to be concentrating on this campaign and why we're so excited about it.
Tell me a little bit more about the listening tour, some of the communities you've already hit, and what it's been like.
You know, it's been incredible. Whenever you get into your car and you've just kind of, you're a hometown guy, became mayor of your small community, you get in the car, you drive a couple of hours, and then you can't find anywhere to park because there's so many people there, you know. It's a really humbling experience. But you know, as I've gone to Central Oregon, I've gone to the coast, it's amazing just how many challenges are the same that our local communities are facing. And you know, there's going to be an opportunity, I think, to really unify the state, because at the end of the day, people want safe communities. They want access to transit and transportation services. They want to be able to enjoy the, you know, the wonder of Oregon, the recreational opportunities we have. They want their kids to go to good schools, and they want to have family wage, you know, jobs when they go to work. And so if we really just focus on those issues that can unite us as Oregonians, I continue to believe there's no problem that we can't take on. it wasn't long ago that the state had a bit of a swagger to us, right? We had guys like Mark Hatfield and Tom McCall. We did innovative things to solve some of our problems, like the bottle bill and public beaches and the Columbia Gorge Highway. There's Oregonians, there's a spirit to this state that I think that we've kind of lost in recent years that we can restore together.
I appreciate the listening tour. It's very ambitious. The number of stops you put on it. I'm wondering if you're getting tired yet. I've seen some folks that do listening tours, quote unquote, that are like 30 minutes long or whatnot. You really set aside some time to listen to folks. I appreciate you doing that. This one's a couple hours. I think most of the ones I've seen are a couple hours that you block out.
Yeah.
The last thing I just want to ask you, Mayor Stan, is I so appreciate you doing events like this, reaching out to all the different communities, really trying to build statewide momentum like you talked about. But at the end of the day, there's Portland, right?
Sure.
And that's a big thing when you're talking about a statewide race that's on partisan lines. So do you have plans for how you would engage that community? Are you going to do events there as well? Or how would you try to obviously reach out to conservative voters in Portland, however many there are, and more moderate or progressive voters as well, which you would ultimately need to do.
One is Sandy's only 25 minutes outside of the Portland area. And in fact, like so many, you know, people that live in communities outside of Portland, my job's in Portland, so I'm having to commute there all of the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you see what's happened to that community over the last 10, 20 years, you know, the gamble that we're going to make, we hear all the time that for a Republican to win statewide, you got to get to this infamous, you know, 30% of the Portland.
Right.
And, you know, the gamble we're going to make is that there's over 30% of people in Portland that are sick and tired of what's happened to their community, that they're sick and tired of seeing the mass homelessness, driving down Marine Drive and just seeing, you know, the display of homeless camp upon homeless camp. And then when those homeless camps leave, the trash remains. They turn on the television sets and they see the riots on the nightly news every night. They hear about the skyrocketing gun violence going on in Portland, the boarded up storefronts. We've got people living in million-dollar homes with folks that take, you know, craps in their front yard in Portland. Yeah. And so the gamble we're going to make is that there's a certain level of livability that people in the Portland area expect and remember that they used to have. And we're going to call it out, you know. Yeah. We're going to remind people what Portland used to be, what it can be, that for a while there, Portland being a little weird was funny. We all enjoyed it, right? We liked it. It ain't so funny anymore.
Yeah.
And I think the people of Portland don't think it's so funny anymore. And that's how we're going to talk to them. And I think that there's young families that look and feel a lot like my young family. You know, Mackenzie and I were middle-class people living in suburbia with middle-class problems and middle-class debt, you know, and we're both working. We've got two young kids in school. This last couple of years, well, this last year and a half, we've had to balance the stay at home and then the virtual learning, the hybrid learning, all of that. Yeah. There's young families that have had to face those exact same challenges that we face, that work-life balance and everything else. So,
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Mayor Stan, for taking time out to talk to us today. We, like I said, are here in Malala at this weekend's event, but you're coming to Canby this upcoming Saturday, May 15th.
Yep.
Do you recall the time? I forget.
I don't. You know, okay. as you mentioned, we're doing so many of these.
I'm going to throw it in here after, so this one, nobody will even hear this part. But anyway, thanks so much.
Thank you. Really appreciate coming out.
Awesome. Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate and we got in a carriage ride with the horse and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple of years. Sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life. Mm-hmm.
How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Police Beat, for basically the entire month of February, from the 9th all the way to March 1st. Man, there was a lot of stuff going on. On February 9th at 9:27 p.m., response to a domestic disturbance call, one person was arrested for endangering the welfare of a minor and assault on a public safety officer. Just getting the month started so right, you know? Just the best of Canby on this one. On February 10th at 5:05 p.m., officers located and stopped a vehicle callers had reported as driving aggressively and arrested the driver for DUI alcohol. February 11th at 12:13 a.m., an unlicensed juvenile was operating a vehicle along with a passenger. Just a couple of cool 14-year-olds. I don't know how old they are, but obviously juvenile, unlicensed. Just driving around. Were stopped for curfew violations. And the cops told on them. Totally narked them out to their parents, dude. I sound so old right now. On February 12th at 12:38 a.m., driver of a vehicle was arrested on multiple outstanding warrants for violating the conditions of his probation. On February 15th at 9:58 a.m., response to a report of an assault. On February 16th at 11:30 p.m., driver arrested for DUI. On February 17th at 2:23 p.m., a package was reported stolen from the front porch of a residence. Didn't we get over this at Christmas? Like, come on. We need to figure this out. At 4:28 p.m., response to a report of a domestic dispute. One involved was subsequently arrested for DUI, criminal trespass, and harassment. On February 18th at 6:21 p.m., response to an alarm sounding at a business. Video surveillance reflected an unknown subject had unsuccessfully attempted to enter the building through a locked door. Because they're closed, don't go in. That's how, when businesses are closed, never mind, it doesn't matter. February 20th. You know, I was reading this one earlier, and I just had to believe that maybe like someone was just having a bad day because it had just been Valentine's Day. But you guys can be the judges of this. February 20th at 8:24 p.m., response to a hit and run crash between a vehicle and a bike. Based on witness descriptions, officers located the suspect vehicle and arrested the driver for DUI alcohol, attempt to elude the police, reckless driving, hit and run, driving while revoked, unlawful possession of multiple firearms, and an outstanding warrant. But here's the thing. That's not the end of it on February 20th. Later, at 11:37 p.m., response to a report of a car crashing into a house and the vehicle's driver running from the location. Drivers searched the area and located the driver, who was cited for DUI, reckless driving, and failing to perform the duties of a driver by driving it into a house. Yeah, everybody fails if they drive their car into a house. And this was all after they were transported to a medical facility. So it was, you know, like a week from Valentine's Day. Maybe those two guys just weren't having a good day, you know? They didn't have a good Valentine's, or maybe it was a good Valentine's Day and a week later, didn't work out so well. I'm not a cop, I don't know. On February 22nd at 8:44 p.m., response to a report of a suspicious vehicle. The driver was subsequently arrested for DUI controlled substances. But what about the vehicle? What happened to it? That was the suspect, though, because it's just creeping around. February 24th at 6:40 p.m., a speeding driver was stopped after narrowly missing an officer who was standing outside of his patrol vehicle. Most of the time, I'd be making fun of the person, calling them a dumb person for almost hitting a cop. But turns out, medical personnel were contacted to evaluate the driver, who appeared to be suffering from a medical condition. So, I actually hope they got taken care of. That sounds terrible. On February 25th at 6:18 p.m., response to a report of an argumentative person refusing to leave a business. The suspect was arrested for criminal trespassing. Because if people don't want you there, you don't have the right to just be like, no, I'm not leaving. That's not how it works. On February 27th at 4:45 p.m., response to a report of a suspicious vehicle. It's back! That darn suspicious vehicle is going around Canby. We got to catch it. The driver was arrested for DUI alcohol. On March 1st at 4:57 p.m., report of burglary after it was reported that a checkbook had been taken from a residence. But the real question here is, who still pays with checks?
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears? Even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? Or no. That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle?
Wait, do you know any trivia that isn't like animal related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Canby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Canby's longest running locally owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Canby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Canby Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Canby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net.
Now Hear This Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe. And we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.